Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. It's Rocket Classic week. It is Live Golf Dallas week. Rex, you've been doing Golf Central all week. I've been doing Golf Today all week. I feel very prepared to talk about whatever it is we want to talk about the comings and goings of the PGA Tour, Live Golf, LPGA, whatever it is you want to dive into.
Am I going to get recycled takes? Is that what's going to happen here? We always talk about this. When you're on air for a prolonged amount of time, you just start workshopping new stuff, and then you just roll it over. Whatever the next show is, just roll it over.
There was a podcast promo that I had to do in the second hour where I was like, oh, wait, I'll be taping that right after we do Golf Today. And so during the show today, we had a Ricky Fowler presser. We had a Colin Morikawa presser, more on that in a little bit. But we also had, Rex, a Keegan Bradley presser. Keegan Bradley, of course, the U.S. Ryder Cup captain, who is fresh off a victory at the Travelers Championship that seemingly has changed everything. Because most importantly, he went from 17th in the U.S. Ryder Cup point standings all the way to 9th. He was not asked directly in his press conference about, you know, with a couple of days of reflection, how do you feel now about the potential prospect of playing on your own team? However, he did have an interview with Golf Channel's Amy Rogers on the broadcast when he said, as of right now, I'm still planning on being, quote, just the captain. If he has settled on that sort of mindset and that mentality for the remaining couple of months of this PGA Tour season, what would be your take on that?
I think he's probably saying the right thing in that situation, if I'm being honest. On Golf Central last night, talked about just rekindling some hot takes. I came to the conclusion, and I think it's fair at this point, and it's based on a point that you made on Sunday night, and I hate giving you credit, but as much as I hate giving you credit, I will on this front, that it is not about what Keegan thinks is necessarily best for the team, even as the captain. This is going to be about what the players think is best for the team. And my guess is strongly that Scottie Scheffler and Colin Morikawa and the rest of the players who are pretty much already qualified for this year's team look around the landscape, not to take anything away from anyone else, and look at Keegan and realize he's best for the team. He's best as a player, not a captain. And I will go back to the other recycle take that I've done. I don't think he can do both. Maybe he can. Maybe there's a way you can piecemeal this together with the vice captains. That's a different conversation. But I think we're at the point now where he could easily win again, but even if he doesn't, I don't imagine how the players around him, the ones that normally have so much say in the decision, the ones who qualify for the team, they think to themselves that, nah, we can be fine without Keegan Bradley. Because right now, I don't think that anyone can make the argument that he's not one of the best 12 Americans.
I mean, he's not even one of the best 12 Americans. He's one of the best 5 Americans. That, according to Data Golf, who has ran the numbers, he's all the way up to a career best 7th in the world. Again, it is incredible, remarkable. Sort of credit to his tenacity, his skill, his concentration, his focus, that he's even put himself in position to potentially be playing golf. Like it's amazing how he's been able to compartmentalize these two aspects of his life. You mentioned what the players want. As we sit here on June 25th, it's pretty clear the sound that we ran, the players do want him on that team. Patrick Cantlay said, look, we saw Tiger Woods do it. He handled it quite ably. Keegan Bradley could probably do the same thing. Different animal. We talked about that on Sunday. Colin Morikawa said, yeah, I think we absolutely want him on the team right now. One of his assistant captains, Webb Simpson, said as much, like, hey, we need him on the American team. The reason why I would still stress caution and patience and sort of a want and need to pump the brakes here is that there are 3 months left until we get to the Ryder Cup. And there are 4 consequential tournaments left in this golf calendar until we get to that point. There's the Open Championship, and there are the 3 FedEx Cup playoff events. Keegan Bradley is 9th in the point standings. Keep in mind, 2 years ago, when he won the Travelers Championship, he moved inside the top 6, and he would have been an automatic qualifier, didn't do much for the rest of the season, ended up sliding all the way to 11th. This is an entirely different animal. And so if Keegan Bradley does not play well in those 4 consequential tournaments, keep in mind he has never played well at the Open Championship, probably owing to his high ball flight. He's never played TPC Southwind, host site of the FedEx St. Jude Championship, particularly well either. If he does not play well in those 4 consequential events, he's going to slide down the rankings, probably thinking that an Andrew Novak or a Maverick McNealy or a Cameron Young, who's been trending nicely, could certainly win this week at the Rocket Classic. Those players could leapfrog him and make this a moot point. If Keegan Bradley is all of a sudden 11th, 12th, 13th in the point standings, I think you could make the case that he would probably be more replaceable as a player. If he sits here at 9th, If he moves up in the standings, I think it's an entirely different conversation. But I think Keegan has done the right thing in sort of stressing patience. There's a long way to go and a lot of golf still to be played.
There really is. But again, I go back to the idea that this didn't come out of nowhere. Maybe you could make the argument late last year that almost felt like it came out of nowhere, although I think he was playing solid going into that victory as well. This time, he's been playing well. He played well at the U.S. Open. He played well at the PGA Championship. I can imagine it is not a stretch to think that maybe he notches one more victory before all is said and done. And it becomes the argument that I had last night on Golf Central, and you're right, maybe I'm being a bit of a prisoner of the moment on this front. However, this now seems like a logistics question. In my mind, the question of him playing or not playing isn't even a conversation anymore. This is about how do you make it work? Fine. You want to call him the playing captain? Okay. But there has to be some sort of logistics. There has to be some sort of administration of how these decisions are going to get made in real time while he's in the middle of a match. Who's going to make those decisions? Which one of the vice captains steps up? How much say is he actually going to have in golf course setup? How much say is he going to have? And who else gets picked? How much say is he going to have in pairings? Right now, we're at the point where I think you need to start sitting down with the PGA of America and the team that you know is going to be on. I mean, the players you know are going to be on that team and come up with exactly what that blueprint's going to look like.
I think it's interesting because I think you can do it where John Wood, the new U.S. team manager, can assume a lot of the administrative duties sort of in the run-up. And he's been bearing that burden for the past couple of months. I think you can hand over the majority of sort of the on-site duties to a Jim Furyk, who's been there before. He's captained it. He's in the backroom staff now. He just capped the President's Cup a year ago. I think you can have, you know, a Webb Simpson, a Kevin Kisner, a Snedeker sort of getting into a situation where he also added responsibility. So I do think it can be done. I think the question though, Rex, is why? Why would you do it? Just for the sake of history? Just for the sake of legacy? Just for the fact that you can say that Keegan Bradley is the first playing captain since 1963? That's not a reason to do it. Because if Keegan Bradley is only going to play two or three times, you can find, you know, a host of other players, a half dozen other players who can do that, who can get you a point and a half if you're going to play two or three times. I would rather have someone who is wholly in. Yes, I absolutely, I'm full confidence
about that.
That a Ben Griffin, if you tee it up and you give him three matches, he could squeeze out a point and a half at home, particularly if you put him with what the analytics team says is a good partner. I have no problem with that whatsoever. It's why would you divide someone's attention and focus intentionally when it just seems like an unnecessary risk to me. Either do one or do the other, but doing both and doing so sort of half-heartedly doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think we're saying the same thing, essentially. Please, go turn your light back on. You look ridiculous. You look like you're being held against your will. So I'll go ahead and gas back just long enough for you to do this. I think we're both saying essentially the same thing. We're just maybe saying it in a little different ways, because what I'm arguing here is that I think it's at the point now, and you're right, there is still plenty of golf to be played, even over the next 6, 7, 8 weeks before we get to the point where selections have to be made. Right now, in this moment in time, I would argue that you're right. He's not one of the 12 best Americans. He's one of the 6 best Americans.
Based right on now, as we sit here at June 25th, again, major championship.
And who do you want on that team? And I'm not going to disparage Ben Griffin or anyone else that's sort of on the outside right now, because that's what I'm going to do tonight on Central. If I had to build a team right now, who would be the picks? And I would put Ben Griffin on that team.
Oh, totally.
However, when it comes to Keegan Bradley, he clinched the point last year at the President's Cup. I know it's a different animal, but you see the passion that he has. When he has played in the Ryder Cup before a decade ago alongside Phil Mickelson, you saw the passion and what he brought to it. He is essentially the American side's Ian Poulter when Ian Poulter was still Ian Poulter. So I would argue, as it stands right now, he is much more beneficial to that team as a player, and that could certainly change. If that's going to be the case, though, I'm speaking more just from an administrative standpoint, from the logistics point of view, where if you're in the back office right now, we need to start thinking about exactly what these protocols are going to look like. When Keegan is in the middle of a match on Saturday afternoon, and we need to come up with the pairings for Saturday morning, and we need to come up with the pairings for Saturday afternoon's matches, who's going to lead that way? Because you're right. He can't be distracted. You can't walk out in the 13th fairway and show him the card and ask him, you go with this? Like, this is what we're going with. Like that, I don't think is an option that you can pull off. And so someone is going to have to take the baton, and they do this anyway.
Or does Keegan just only play in the afternoons?
I guess that would be one way to do it. I don't necessarily think as a captain, you would want to shoehorn yourself though, saying that, this guy can only play in the afternoons because of something that has to do.
He's probably only going to play in four balls anyway, if history's any indication.
Probably. I would say that they do this anyway. Like, you allow vice captains to give advice on par threes, for example, and you just pass it along. And there's a referee kind of in the middle that understands that someone else has the baton now. He can go give advice. And Keegan Bradley has given that right up. It would be something similar to that, would be my guess, whether that's Brent Snedeker or Webb Simpson or whoever else is in the back office. But I keep coming back to the idea that the modern Ryder Cup, and I understand what Patrick Cantlay was saying about Tiger Woods at the President's Cup, that is an entirely different animal. It was a President's Cup in Australia. There is not nearly the pressure or the demands on your time or everything else that goes into being a captain.
It's one session each day.
You have plenty of support. The PGA Tour is completely there behind you. This, you're kind of on your own. And I think we have had these conversations, you and I, with previous captains. I've had this conversation with Jim Furyk. You and I both have had it with Paul McGinley. The job in the modern era is so intense and requires so much exacting knowledge, so much exacting decisions, that I just don't know how you can do both and be affected at it.
I think a lot of golf fans and golf observers are thinking about the best case scenario, that here's a guy who's playing good golf. Here's a guy who clearly has a heart and passionate desire for the event. You know, let him just go run free and fire up the crowd with birdies and let him earn some points. What if he doesn't? What if he, as a playing captain, he does not play well? If he's not firing up the crowd with birdies, all of a sudden you have just handed on a silver plate to the Europeans, not just a point because one of the U.S. players did not play well. You have also then defeated the captain and the potential rush that could give them, sort of taking the head off of the king, so to speak. And so I think there's a psychological boost when you look at that respect as well. Like, we're always looking at just the positive. Well, he's going to continue to play well because that's what he's doing right now. It's 3 months down the line. Form ebbs and flows. I do think Keegan Bradley, at least at this point on June 25th, is saying the right things, that let's give it some time. As of right now, I would just like to be the captain. One of the other players in the mix this week in Detroit, Rex, who has certainly come under some scrutiny over the past couple of months, is Colin Morikawa, who once again split with a caddy. First, it was JJ Jakubek. On Tuesday, it was reported that he is now split with Joe Greiner, who had filled in over the past five tournaments. All have made cuts. However, he has not had a top 10, has Colin Morikawa, in his last eight tournaments. He's had a pretty decorated career. This is tied for the longest stretch he has ever gone without a top 10 finish. He's sparring with reporters in a press conference setting. What do you think is going on here with one Colin Morikawa?
I mean, he's clearly not pleased with his game. And I would point to Joe Greiner, who is one of the absolute best caddies in the game. And it's the old cliche that there's only two kinds of caddies on the PGA Tour, those who have been fired and those who are about to be fired. You can say the same thing about swing coaches and fitness guys and everything else down the line. Once something starts going wrong inside that chain, inside the player's chain of his universe, he's going to start picking away things that he feels like, or is going to be this. If I get rid of this and put a new one of those in there, that it's going to fix everything. Because what the player can't do, and this is understandable, I don't particularly agree with it all the time, but the player can't look himself in the mirror and be like, yes, I'm the problem. I've got to try to fix this. Like, sometimes you have to kind of turn and deflect a little bit. And more times than not, the caddies or the swing coaches end up taking the brunt of that. That sounds like what's happening here. Joe will not be unemployed for very long. I think the bigger component
is... He won with Justin Thomas at the Heritage as a fill-in.
He's a great caddy, just like JJ Jakubek before him. They'll land on their feet. They'll end up with really good bad soon. This has nothing to do with them. I think the bigger issue is what you sort of glossed over a little bit. And I actually did not see the press conference. You did, doing it during Golf Today. But it's an exchange between Colin Morikawa and a reporter from Golf Week, a colleague of ours, Adam Shupak. And I'm going to let you do the reading.
Yeah, so this was towards the end of the press conference where the reporter Adam Shupak asked Colin, as you can see on the screen here, if you're following along on audio, I'll try to summarize it for you, that, you know, do you know who was going to caddy for you at the Open Championship? This is just supposed to be a one-week fill-in for Colin Morikawa's former college teammate, KK Limbasut, his former teammate at Berkeley. He's actually a Korn Ferry Tour player, tried a Monday qualifier, did not able to get through this week. And Colin Morikawa said, I don't. And then Colin seemed to take issue with how Adam Shupak went about trying to get that story. And it appeared on Twitter at golfweek.com earlier today with confirmation from Colin that this was that they had split with Joe Greiner. He was going a different direction. He had the 1 week film with KK this week, and he didn't know what was happening going forward. But he also included a quote, did Shupak, essentially saying, I'm trying to be with my pro-am partners right now. I will answer your questions, any questions you have, in about 2.5 hours. Shupak apparently approached Colin Morikawa on the first tee of the pro-am to try and get confirmation. Rex, you and I have been doing this job long enough. Can you explain to listeners and viewers why a PGA Tour player might take exception with that? And what is just sort of the general protocol between a reporter and a player during a pro-am round if you're trying to get some information?
Well, and first and foremost, I don't think Colin Morikawa appreciated how the narrative was maybe framed in Adam Shupak's story about he seemed to send the message that, no, I don't want to talk to you. I want to play in the pro-am right now. So I think there's a bit of a disagreement between Shupak and Morikawa on that front. And I would encourage everyone to go read the story and decide for yourself not to take sides. As far as how the protocols work, it's very clear. On the first hole of a playoff, I mean, on the first hole of a pro-am, that's not when you go up and talk to a player. I will say that over the years, I have learned that pro-ams are the perfect time to talk to players. But if it's a 9-9, which this week was, which meant that you're only going to play 9 holes and another pro is going to step in and when you make the turn. If it's a 9-9, you usually go out and you try to find him on the 7th or 8th tee.
Yep.
And by that time, they have done everything they needed to do with their amateur partners. And look, don't mix this up. Playing in the pro-am is part of the job. This isn't fun for a lot of players, but they understand that it's an important part of the job. It creates revenue for the tournaments. It also creates relationships between players and more times than not corporate potential corporate sponsors. Like, there's a lot of reasons for players to embrace the pro-am as an important part of their job. In this particular instance, I feel like Colin Morikawa was doing just that, where he is on the first tee and he has 3 pro-am partners, and it's his job to essentially keep them entertained over the course of the next 2.5 hours or 9 holes. Now, normally that only is going to last 6 or 7 hours. The PGA Tour going to the 9-9 format, I thought, was one of the most brilliant things that's ever come out of Ponte Vedra Beach, because most pro-am partners, they don't want to spend 5 hours with the same pro. They would much rather split it up and to get 2 pros. I get to ask this guy the same questions I ask that guy. Maybe he has a different personality.
But players are more engaged because they know it's only a 2.5 hour commitment as opposed to 5.5.
Exactly. And so the protocol here, and again, I would refer to the idea that over the course of our careers, we've discovered that the pro-am is a really good time to go out and talk to players in a less formal setting, probably largely off the record, just about any number of topics. You don't do it on the first tee. You wait until they get to the 6th tee or the 7th tee, the 8th tee, whatever the case may be. And you also keep those conversations relatively short. I don't think I've ever gone more than 1 hole with a player just talking about whatever it is I wanted to address and then send them on their way, because they still have a job to do with the pro-ams. And so I think there is things that there were probably stop signs here that Adam just simply ran through.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always cognizant of when players are on the range and they're clearly working on something. They're in the middle of a deep dive with their swing coach. That's not the time to sidle up there and ask questions. The first day of a pro-am wouldn't be the time to ask questions. It could be before the pro-am, you know, when the pro is getting ready on the putting green. If it actually rose to a situation where it's that urgent that you needed an answer at that point, I would not say that Colin Morikawa changing caddies again would rise to the level that would sort of need that sort of intervention. Again, you wait till 7, 8, 9. Give the pro-am playing partners opportunity. They're paying a lot of money to be in that setting. It's just like a general respect thing that clearly Colin Morikawa felt was violated here. I also think, Rex, that Colin Morikawa is clearly sensitive to how he has been portrayed over these past couple of months as sort of the poster child for a player who is stiff-arming reporters and the media, stemming from what happened on Sunday at Bay Hill. And I brought this up on Golf Today, where it's easy to look at that as sort of an isolated incident and a player who is clearly steamed because he just kicked away the tournament. He doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to talk to reporters. He doesn't want to talk to anyone at that. That happens all year long. That happens in every other sport. LeBron James doesn't talk after every single loss. If he has a bad game, something goes down at the wire, he will sometimes blow out of there before reporters get to the locker room. This happens in every sport all year long. So I sort of I sort of understand what happened there with Colin Morikawa. What people forget is that 2 days later at the Players' Championship, we asked Colin Morikawa like a dozen questions about his inability to close out tournaments, and he was terrific. He was introspective. He was really thoughtful about it. He did not stiff arm. He wasn't rude. Like, yes, he made the comment, but I don't owe you guys anything. But he was still sitting there in the press conference. He was still answering all the questions. It's just, I think he's pushing back against sort of this perception that people now have about him. And I think it's fair, and he's understandably pissed that this is how he's been portrayed.
What's going on with the lights? Have we not paid the bills in Connecticut? What's happening there?
It's clearly if I sit still long enough for like 10 minutes, the light is going to go off. And so we probably need to wrap up this podcast sometime in the next 10 minutes. But please carry on the conversation while I address this once more.
Go ahead. No, I'll gas bag for a little while longer. Because to your point, yes. And to be fair, because I feel as if the narrative on this front between the media and the players has gotten a little exaggerated. And by that, I mean Rory McIlroy being the primary example when he went 6 consecutive major championship rounds without speaking to the media. Lost in that is the fact that he did pre-round press conferences, both at the PGA Championship. He did them in New Orleans when he was there for the Zurich Classic. He did it at the U.S. Open. So it's not as though they're not talking to the media. And I probably leaned into it a little bit more than I should have on Sunday night, only because Tommy Fleetwood, coming off the heartbreaking loss at the Travelers Championship, took the time to speak with the media and sort of crack the egg open and let us see all of the pain, all of the suffering, all of the tears. And that's sort of what we want as reporters. We want to be able to tell that story to the public and let them know that this is so important to Tommy and hear how he was, I believe the words he used are hurt and angry, and it's going to take me a while to get over this. Those are the stories that we want to tell. I'm with you. I understand it when a player doesn't want to tell those stories afterward, when it's still too raw, too fresh. I think the only thing I would say that Colin Morikawa was guilty of is maybe tone at the Players' Championship when he said that I don't owe you anything. That comes off as a little grating, probably comes off as a little self-serving. But the fact of the matter is, and I've said this repeatedly, he doesn't. None of them owe anything to the media. I have argued, however, that they do owe something to the fans and the corporate sponsors and the tournament organizers who go out of their way and work all year long to create this 1 week out of the year for them. But they don't owe anything to the media.
I hope that part of the podcast was educational for folks who might be confused about why Colin Morikawa would take exception with that and what sort of the protocol is between a media and a player during a pro-am. Rex, one other tournament of note this week is LIV Golf Dallas being played at Merido. This is one of two tournaments that LIV golfers have in advance of the Open Championship, also playing in Spain the week prior to going to Royal Portrush. It's going to be blazing hot temperatures at Merido. We certainly know that. But any LIV golfers in particular that you want to track over these next couple weeks as we look ahead to the year's final major?
Well, yeah, I think Bryson DeChambeau is one of the most compelling figures in the game. And I wouldn't necessarily pick Royal Portrush as I started the season as somewhere where I expect him to...
Played well in an Open.
He has never played well in the Open. And like, I think this goes to the heart of what Bryson DeChambeau is. He hates variables. He wants to get rid of all the variables that the game presents to him. And links golf is nothing about and is about only about variables, where you don't know exactly what the wind's going to do. You don't know exactly what the ball is going to do when it hits the turf as it bounces. You don't know if you're going to end up in one of those pot bunkers and have a shot out or have no shot whatsoever. That entire brand of golf, I don't think, is something that he embraces right now. I have always pointed to how I would have said the same thing for the vast majority of Phil Mickelson's career, right up until he won an Open Championship. So I do think there is still plenty of runway for Bryson to find a way to figure out links golf. However, I'm not sure if this is the year, but yeah, I mean, I think he's probably one of the top two or three compelling figures in the game right now.
He certainly is. Again, I don't have money and I don't have many expectations as it relates to Bryson in the Open Championship. I'm going to focus on a couple other players. There is a spot, Rex, in the Open available for the highest earning LIV player among the top five who is not already eligible. So Joaquin Neiman's already wrapped up his spot. Bryson, John Rahm have already wrapped up his spot. Right now, if it ended today, that spot would actually go to Sergio Garcia, which is notable for a couple reasons. He didn't play in the U.S. Open, first time in about 25 years that he did not play in our national championship. Also, with the Ryder Cup prospects, Sergio Garcia has not been playing his best golf over the past couple months after being in pretty good form for about a year. That would be another opportunity to show Captain Luke Donald, show the other players on the team that he still has the goods and still would warrant potentially a pick for that European Ryder Cup team heading back to Bethpage Black. I look, Rex, also at John Rahm, who his major championship record this year looks awfully good. T14 at the Masters, had a great weekend there. Obviously, we know what happened at the PGA Championship. It was tied for lead with 9 holes to go at Quail Hollow before sliding back in the back nine, ended up finishing in joint eighth. And also the U.S. Open, started out hot, battled back, had a good Sunday final round as well, ended up finishing in a tie for seventh. John Rahm is too good to have gone this long against lesser competition and less competition in general on LIV Golf without a win in 2025. It feels like he's trending towards something big. Perhaps that starts this week at LIV Dallas. Also, LIV Golf Andalusia and Valderrama beckons as well in Spain. Obviously, you know John Rahm is going to be up for a home game. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. You guys know the drill. NBCSports.com/golf for all Lay's news, notes, and updates. Rex and I'll be back on Sunday night for a full 52-minute edition. If you have some questions for that podcast show related to the Rocket Classic, LIV Golf Dallas, anything else that is on your mind, feel free to hit us up in the YouTube comment section. We will get to it on the show. We're going to have plenty of time to fill, folks. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you guys on Sunday.